Hello, and joining you this week from a location in the UK which will hopefully not require me to call upon the hospitality of Davey and Shona Findlay, whose invitation to use their bathroom during the protest enforced stoppage at Sunday's Men's World Road Race Championship. Mathieu van der Poel, partly credited with his winning ride. Scottish newspaper The Daily Record's front page headline the next day: thank poo very much. My name is Daniel Freeber, and that will hopefully be the last scatological reference in this episode of the Cycling Podcast, or indeed ever again, in which we'll reach for the bleach and hopefully clean up whatever lingering questions and odours we, or indeed you, may have had after Sunday's Arrivé episode. Joining us to do that today is a man who was in Glasgow at the weekend, rode the road race, but as far as we know, did not avail himself of the Findlay facilities. He is the Motown maestro, so there is the temptations, get it? In fact, to borrow the words and sentiments of a famous song, and speaking of cleaning and all things non-lavatorial, the way he sweeps us off our feet, he could be our broom, the way he smells so sweet, you know, he could be sweet perfume. Larry, we haven't had you for a while.
I know, I miss you guys.
Yeah, last seen, Larry Warbass last seen on the penultimate day of the Giro off the finish line, striking a pose for us just after you'd finished your time trial. But good to have you back, Larry, and you were in Glasgow at the weekend, and we'll be talking about your world championship with my co-host, fellow opening batsman, Lionel Burney. Lionel, how are you? Where are you?
Well,
what's going on?
I'm just at home, Daniel, and I was impressed you even mentioned the toilet break van der Poel made during the protest on Sunday.
I was up at 7 o'clock this morning, scrambling, floundering around, trying to think of something obtuse to say in today's intros, and that was the first thing that came to mind. If I'd had a bit more time to prepare, I wouldn't have got a mention.
Funny, actually, I didn't even know about that.
No. At least he used the toilet, unlike Tom Dumoulin a few years ago, remember, at the Giro. Well, you remember with horror, Daniel. It dominated an episode of the podcast, and it was an unusual one, wasn't it? I mean, I don't want to go deeply into this, but...
No, please don't.
Because when you've got to go, you've got to go. But slightly unusual to need a number two during the middle of a race, Larry, or was that not... unusual.
And he was apparently the fourth or fifth Dutch member of the Dutch envoy who had availed himself of Davey Findlay, who was proudly posed next to the toilet itself for the Daily Record, I should add.
I'll be honest, I also kind of needed to do the same, but I didn't really consider that as an option. I mean, the problem was, you know, first, we actually just came barreling down this road. You know, it was a super narrow road. It was kind of like important for positioning because it was just before. It was like, yeah, it was like one of the most narrow spots on the course before the circuit. And then we were kind of barreling into this downhill before like the only kind of climb. And we were flying down this road, and then all of a sudden we just stopped, you know, and so I guess we didn't know how long we were going to be there for a while. So I don't think any of us really considered that as an option. But yeah, I mean, I probably peed 3 times while we were stopped, actually. but yeah.
On a serious note, I've heard riders over the last couple of years when we have had stoppages for various reasons. I remember one in Paris-Nice, the stage start was moved forward or back because of inclement weather. But with the amount that you guys eat these days, particularly pre-race, but also during races, this can cause a bit of a problem, can't it? And also, Larry, Lionel and I were talking on the day of the race on Sunday. I sort of suggested that for some riders, having effectively an hour off in the middle of the race might have been pretty helpful. But I did see other riders in their post-race interviews talk about how it sort of messed with their legs,
yeah,
maybe their head slightly.
I actually think, yeah, I mean, like, personally, I think it probably hurt more than anything because we were like right at the front already. And I don't know, it's like you stop for 50 minutes. And actually, the kind of confusing thing is, like, you know, now, like you were saying, we eat a lot, right? And you have this like kind of fueling strategy But like, we don't really have some sort of strategy for like, if you stop for 50 minutes in the middle of the race, right? You know, but then you're still going there and you're like kind of hungry. So then it was like, I don't know, for me, for example, maybe I had maybe like a gallon of barb when we were stopped or something. And then we got started and I actually felt like maybe I ate too much as we were stopped, you know? And the thing was like, we started in a full sprint, but it was kind of funny because the whole time you're sort of like, even though you're stopped, like we're still jostling for position, you know? So like there's still the fight. And actually the best part was like, so, you know, it's kind of like self-policing, you know, everyone knows where everyone was. So like, you know, if someone was trying to like move up from where they were, you know, like people are like yelling. But anyway, there was this one kid from Rwanda who he's just walking up the side from the back. You know, he was like in the back and he just starts walking up. Everyone starts yelling like, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? He goes up to Wout van Aert and he's like, can I have a photo with you? And and his director had come with him and his director takes a photo of this Rwandan guy with Wout van Aert. And then the whole peloton started cheering actually, which was, it was awesome. It was pretty funny. And then the guy just stayed in the front actually. But everyone was cool with it because it was a pretty funny, funny story. But yeah.
You should have waited a few hours. If you'd asked Van Aert for a photo at maybe half four in the afternoon, he could have got himself a medal.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, yeah, the thing was once we started again, it was like a full sprint. And actually, I think it kind of like hurt the breakaway a little bit because like, I think they were so scared to perhaps like, you know, lose time on the breakaway that, I mean, we went like bats out of hell, like from the restart. And yeah, I think it was also because we were probably like max 10 minutes from this climb. And so for me, the hardest part of the day was probably this like little restart. And I think actually I never really recovered from that like acceleration before we hit the circuit. So yeah.
You don't love, I remember talking to you during the Giro, you don't love those explosive starts, do you? I remember the day of the shortened stage at the Giro to Crans-Montana, you were not thrilled about that, were you?
Yeah.
Because you knew it was going to be explosive and particularly the start was going to be fast.
Yeah, I mean, that was also a little bit different because like when that day is so short, it's like, then it's just the purest climbers. We started at the bottom of the climb, right? So then it was the purest climbers we're going to get in the breakaway. Whereas like for me, I kind of need like a long, you know, a battle before like the breakaway goes. Otherwise, like it's hard, you know, that day, like for example, aside from Derek G, the breakaway, we're all like 50 kilos. And then, yeah, Derek G, who was just like, yeah, a god there. So, so yeah.
Chaps, should we have a news roundup before we hear more about Larry's World Championship and the World Championship road race in general? Lionel, I'm on duty this week, so feel free to interject with any mistakes that I might make. There may be a few because we'll mainly be indoors for this week's news roundup. So I'm going to round up some of the other action that's been happening in Glasgow. It's mainly been on the track, so we'll start there. Track, cycling and toilets. I couldn't be further outside my comfort zone this week. I'll mainly focus on some of the names familiar from outdoor cycling, where we are on more familiar ground, and that's more generally our can of iron brew on the cycling podcast. So on the women's side, we've had Chloe Dygert winning the individual pursuit ahead of Franziska Pauser. While in the team pursuit, the British quartet of Archibald, Barker, Knight and Morris edged out Denmark. Barker, that is Eleanor Barker, and her teammate Noah Evans also won the Madison. Sticking with endurance events, Lotta Kopecky followed up her outstanding Tour de France by taking gold in the points race and the elimination, while your compatriot Larry Jennifer Valente took the scratch race. On the men's side, on Sunday, Filippo Ganna overhauled Dan Bigham in the dying meters of a thrilling individual pursuit final to take gold in that discipline. This after Ganna's Italian team had lost out to Denmark in the team pursuit a couple of days earlier. Lionel, you watched the individual pursuit you were telling me earlier?
I did indeed, yeah. Very close between Bigham and Ganna in the final, I think. And Bigham was a key part of Filippo Ganna's world hour record support crew, wasn't he? He's well, he's a kind of player manager, isn't he, Dan Bigham? Rider, coach, performance analyst. Really knows his stuff on, you know, aerodynamics and pacing strategy and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, quite a remarkable result that Dan Bigham, who, you know, let's face it, is we wouldn't think of as being in the same bracket as Filippo Ganna, obviously is, because he held the world hour record that Ganna broke, didn't he? But to push him so close and get a silver medal in the individual pursuit, really extraordinary ride. And Jonathan Milan, you know, another Italian phenomenon, really. Won the points jersey at the Giro this year, won a stage at the Giro, didn't he? And, well, you may well mention his upcoming transfer, but bronze medal for him. So, yeah, it feels like the kind of the road stars are kind of back in individual pursuit land at the World Championships with, well, in the form of Ganna and Milan, certainly.
Said the Italian silver in the individual in the team pursuit, gold in the individual pursuit with Ganna. Only ecstasy, no agony for Portugal as they took their first ever gold medal at Track Worlds thanks to Yuri Leitão, who won the Omnium. Leitão usually plies his trade on the road for Caja Rural, who will be at the Vuelta in a few weeks' time, having missed out last year. There are also titles for two British riders, William Tidball and Ethan Vernon, in scratch race and elimination, respectively. Tidball rides on the road for St. Piran and Vernon for Soudal Quickstep. In the Madison, the Dutch pair of Jan Willem van Skip and Yuri Havik ran out winners. And talking of team events that may take the uninitiated a little while to understand, back on the road, Switzerland once again triumphed in the team time trial mixed relay. Congrats to Stefan Kung, Stefan Bissiger, Mauro Schmidt, Elie Chabet, Nicole Collier and Marlon Reusser, who led the Swiss home despite a crash. Reusser had a crash in the women's leg half of the mixed team time trial relay. They won by 7 seconds from France and they were 51 seconds clear of Germany. Elsewhere, the transfer merry-go-round that opened 9 days ago slowly cranking into gear. Not too many unveilings in the last couple of days, but we have had Little Trek, as you said, Lionel, confirming that Jonathan Milan will ride for them for the next 3 years. Another sprinter, the German Max Kanter, is leaving Movistar for Astana, and Sven-Erik Biestrom is going from Intermarché to Groupama FDJ. We mentioned Portugal and Yuri Leitão earlier. Well, UAE have pulled off a major coup by recruiting the 19-year-old Portuguese Antonio Morgado, winner of the Giro della Lunigiana junior race last year. We featured that in a kilometre zero in this year's adult Giro, full Giro. Morgado, Larry, is much talk about him on the sort of pro peloton grapevine. He's one of the latest in a series of riders that UAE have tried to sign up very young, very early. Jan Christian, also, I should have mentioned, Swiss rider who's also going to UAE, hotly tipped for great things, Morgado.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of talk about him, but I think it's probably because he rides for Axion, and some of the guys who used to ride for Axion told me that, yeah, this guy is supposed to be like, you know, the next great thing. So, yeah, that's the only thing I'd heard about him, but I don't really know a whole lot about him. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of slightly more senior but still prodigies, young prodigies, nonetheless, Remco Evenepoel has urged his father and Soudal Quickstep boss Patrick Lefebvre to stop discussing his future in public. This after Patrick, that is Remco's dad, hinted again that he could leave Soudal Quickstep before the end of his contract, which is due to expire in 2026. And the other Patrick, that is Lefebvre, said the Evenepoel family should harmonise their violins. Lefebvre's exact quote: last week Remco said that the bullshit has to end. Barely a week later, his father says the opposite. The Evenepoel family must harmonise the violins. Lionel.
Well, I mean, think back to Patrick Evenepoel's big transfer from Histor to Kolstrop 1991. Same level of controversy. He'd won the Serang Arkan Serang Kermesse and was the subject of a big money move to one of the other kind of Belgian B-list teams, Kolstrup. No, this is actually true. That was Patrick Evenepoel's probably the highlight of his career, actually. He also won the Grand Prix de Wallonie in 1993.
That's actually a good race.
That is a good race. Yeah, so that was his one kind of real pro win, Patrick Evenepoel. Yeah, it's a tricky one, this, isn't it? I mean, you know, Remco Evenepoel is still a very young man. It wouldn't, you know, it's not a surprise that his family are deeply invested in his career. It's just when it spills over into the media and becomes kind of, you know, butting of heads, Patrick versus Patrick. I can imagine some kind of Netflix series on this, maybe.
Yeah, these rumours are rumbling on, though, about particularly about Ineos, and Ineos potentially even buying out Patrick Lefebvre, buying the team, buying the licence, effectively, which seems a strange one. I mean, particularly with Remco tied down to a long-term contract, and obviously two Belgian sponsors there, you would think they would be very happy to have him on the books, and there would be no... There'll be no thought of them leaving professional cycling at this moment in time. But Larry, I don't know what you've heard about Sudal Quickstep for next year. I mean, there is some talk as well about the fact they've not got many riders tied down to contracts. I know there have been riders trying to negotiate renewals, and Patrick Lefebvre has been telling them that he hasn't got any money. But on the other hand, we've got, Lefebvre himself pretty much confirming that Mikel Landa is going to go there as a domestique for Remco. There are rumours that George Bennett is also going to Sudal Quickstep as a domestique for Remco as well. So all a little bit murky at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard any of that, but I heard about both George Bennett and Mikel Landa, and you know, I heard that they're really trying to strengthen their climbing support, but I would say the whole not having any money thing is classic Lefebvre, you know, businessman always trying to get people for cheap, which he seems to be able to do. And, you know, I mean, I think it's seen as a team that always performs well. And, you know, I think a lot of riders are happy to go there because, you know, they have good equipment, and it usually seems like they're able to get the best out of, a lot of riders. So, you know, I think they're able to probably get guys cheaper than most other teams. Due to both of those things. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've heard all these rumors, and yeah, I heard, you know, that the boss of Ineos really wants to win the tour in, you know, the next however many years. And he sees that, you know, aside from the two dudes who got first and second, who are pretty tied up, the only other guy who could maybe do it is Remco. And so, you know, the thing is I could never imagine Lefebvre letting him go. I mean, unless it was the most unreal amount of money, you know, he has to get something out of it. And, you know, I mean, Remco is like a Belgian national hero now. So to me, it would be the dumbest thing ever, even for an absurd amount of money. You know, if I had a pro cycling team, I wouldn't let him go, especially if I were Belgian. You know, if I was in his shoes, I wouldn't let him go. So
it's a delicate dance, this, though, isn't it? I mean, Patrick Lefebvre has run this team for a long time. He's 68 years old. He did once say in an interview that I did with him for Friends of the Podcast that, you know, when he decides it's time to stop, he will just stop, and that will be that. You know, and he has his exit strategy in mind. He's not going to go on forever. He kind of does. I mean, one of the quotes was, if you don't respect your contract, you get sued. And that's one of Lefebvre's kind of MOs, isn't it? His modus operandi is get the riders. I'm not saying that Remco Evenepoel's been signed on the cheap, you know, probably a very big contract that he's got. But there's this sense, having got him for a number of years to the end of 2026, you know, there is a sense that Remco Evenepoel could outgrow this contract to a degree, especially if there's significant and firm interest from a rival team. And it's this delicate dance, isn't it, between the ink on the contract and kind of the market value. Well, and that's where it gets sensitive and tricky. Lefebvre is a man who believes that the contract speaks louder than absolutely everything else. And we know that in the real world and, you know, the world of soccer, you know, kind of shows the way, you know, a contract can be... Yeah, I mean, it depends, though, doesn't it? You could...
And Quickstep have done that. Lefebvre's done that himself. There have been occasions when he's bought riders out of contracts.
Or he's put the squeeze on to sort of move riders on when he's decided he doesn't want them. I mean, the list is significant, isn't it? I mean, you know, the sense that Julian Alaphilippe was maybe getting the Sam Bennett treatment earlier this year, you know, was palpable, wasn't it? So... yeah, it's one to watch this, and the fact that, you know, Evenepoel, as the kind of, I don't want to sort of you know, be glib about this, but, you know, him saying that both his dad and Lefebvre should stay quiet about this, you know, the athlete kind of caught in the middle in the sort of the child role, if you like, when he is the talent who could deliver, well, like you say, Larry, probably the only person that really could challenge Tadej Pogacar and Jonas Vingegaard in next year's Tour de France, perhaps.
Right, he's also someone who's more than capable of and more than eloquent enough to speak for himself. Remco Evenepoel does a pretty good job of communicating through the media. One thing I would say, Lionel, I spoke a couple of days ago to a rider who used to represent Patrick Lefebvre's team, and we were talking about this, the likelihood of Lefebvre getting out and maybe selling the whole business, the team, to Ineos, Jim Radcliffe. And legacy and legacy to Belgian cycling are also a question. I think that maybe for more sort of important in Patrick Lefebvre's thinking than people might maybe imagine. I don't think that the optics of him sort of selling almost the de facto Belgian national team and the Belgian national talisman, i.e. Remco Evenepoel, to, well, someone of any other nationality, but particularly, you know, Jim Radcliffe, a kind of nouveau riche of professional cycling, would go down particularly well.
You think
he also
cares?
Worth mentioning. Yeah. Also, well, Lefebvre only owns a fifth of the team. The other 80% is owned by the Czech gazillionaire Zdeněk Bakala, isn't it? So
that is true.
You know, it's not solely Lefebvre's to sell.
That is true. Yeah,
I did see the whole thing about him saying he'll retire sometime soon. It did cross my mind, like maybe he's like, okay, I'll just cash out, sell Remco for a bunch of money, and then just run. You know, but I don't know if that would happen.
Chaps, finally, we'll end the news roundup with some sad news. The death yesterday at 95 years of age of Federico Bahamontes, a.k.a. the Eagle of Toledo. Bahamontes was the first Spaniard to win the Tour de France in 1959. He was also the King of the Mountains on 6 occasions and indeed completed the clean sweep of mountains titles in all major tours. He also won over 70 races in total. Lionel, a real sort of icon of the 20th century in professional cycling, undoubtedly one of the greatest climbers of all time. I mean, you watch old footage of Federico Bahamontes, and you can watch, you know, even if you watch Eddie Merckx in the 70s or even certain riders in the 80s, it's almost hard to imagine them excelling or looking good in today's peloton, just because of the, you know, the sort of style, the body movements look completely different, mainly because of the technology. But Bahamontes is someone who you watch back, and he looks as good in sort of the 1950s as the best and most elegant and most swashbuckling climbers of today look nowadays.
Yeah, and I think he was very much to the forefront of our minds during the tour because of the stage to Le Puy de Dôme, which is where, Bahamontes won the time trial on Le Puy de Dôme in 1959, which effectively set him up for the overall victory in that year's tour. And if I'm not mistaken, Bahamontes climbed Le Puy de Dôme quicker than the stage winner this year, Mike Woods, and was only sort of 2 minutes 50 or something, 3 minutes or thereabouts off Tadej Pogacar's, you know, kind of, I guess we have to call all-time record on Le Puy de Dôme. I know, it hasn't been climbed by the Tour since 1988, so it's a bit like comparing apples and oranges, I guess. But, I mean, that puts into context, you know, Bahamonte's brilliance as an athlete, someone who probably wouldn't be all that out of place today. And I suppose that late 50s era, you know, the Anquetil, Charlie Gall, that was when cycling was becoming a kind of a sport in rather than this kind of battle of survival. I know obviously Coppi had preceded and he was the sort of bridge, I guess, between the Tour de France being this sort of endurance feat, you know, sort of the privateers and the, almost with the sort of the bike packing and gravel racing spirit of today, I guess, you know, that was how the Tour de France started. Whereas by the late 50s, these guys were stars in Europe and in their own countries. I mean, Bahamonte was paid a huge amount of money, wasn't he, by the teams that he rode for, especially when you're thinking of, you know, 1950 Spain, 1960 Spain was not a particularly wealthy country. I mean, he would have been one of the big stars, you know. And when you talk about the rivalry or the sort of comparisons between cycling and football in Spain, you know, Bahamonte is kind of the, I guess, the sort of Real Madrid figure, isn't he, of Spanish cycling. The first to win the Tour, that's significant. Obviously, then Ocaña came next, and then, well, then a big gap between Ocaña and Pedro Delgado. But yeah, Bahamonte's the nickname as well, the Eagle of Toledo, the King of the Mountains titles, which I think Lucien Van Impe leveled, didn't he? He was six in the 70s or early 80s, and then obviously Richard Virenque overtook that with seven titles, but obviously a bit of an asterisk against some of those or all of those. But yeah, I was talking to Alistair Fotheringham, who knew Bahamontes well, and he just painted a picture of a character, someone who was larger than life, you know, until his very latest years. And I think he was at the Vuelta, wasn't he, a few years ago when Primoz Roglic was in the lead or had won a stage. And yeah, he still enjoyed keeping up with the cycling, and I suppose was somebody who laid the groundwork and the blueprint for modern Spanish cycling and the love of climbers.
Yes, Lionel, he was a great character. I interviewed him a few years ago, and he was notoriously salty about Richard Virenque and losing that sort of record of King of the Mountains titles, and sort of didn't really consider Virenque a proper climber. But a great character, was very sort of spry and lively deep into his 90s. And he'd come, I mean, as you mentioned Ocaña, both he and Ocaña, sort of some of the mystique around them derived from the fact they'd both come from abject poverty in the Bahamontes family. They sort of moved around the kind of Madrid area due to, or sort of in the wake of the Spanish Civil War, and the Bahamontes dad would break rocks and sold them for road building, and Federico sort of helped him with this, and also sort of sold scrap metal and rescued kind of live ammunition from trenches used in the Civil War to just sort of get a few pesetas together, and that's how he sort of bought his first bike. But yeah, a real icon of Spanish cycling. The mayor of Toledo, Carlos Velasquez, yesterday declared there'd be 2 days of official mourning, and Federico Bahamondes is no doubt someone who'll be very much in our thoughts at the Vuelta a España in a few weeks' time.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN. A VPN is a virtual private network to keep all of your devices safe and secure when you're browsing online. Daniel's off to the Vuelta shortly, and I know he uses a VPN not just to watch Arsenal matches when he's not in the UK, but also to keep his data safe and secure. And I've been a NordVPN customer since before they started sponsoring the podcast, and I signed up initially because I wanted to make sure that my internet connections on the move were secure, especially when doing sensitive stuff like logging onto the bank account. Wanted to make sure that I was doing so in a secure way. And when you're using 4G or 5G or using the hotel Wi-Fi, some of those connections, well, I wasn't all that confident that they would be secure. And now I use NordVPN when I'm at home as well, because it gives that safety and security. And if you want the same security when you're online, go to nordvpn.com/ TCP and sign up. It would apparently take the world's most powerful computer billions of years to unencrypt your data when you are using the NordVPN. So if you sign up at nordvpn.com/TCP and go for the 2-year plan, you'll get an additional 4 months on top. And that covers all of the plans, whether you sign up for Standard Plus or Complete Cover. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP. It's also completely risk-free because Nord offer a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you sign up and think it's not something you're going to benefit from, then you can get your money back. But I'm pretty confident once you've used NordVPN and you see that it's preventing your devices from downloading any malware or having any of your connections interrupted, or that it doesn't slow down your internet connection at all when you are connected, you will see the benefits of using NordVPN.
Well, chaps, we, and well, listeners, we promised you that we would hear about Larry's World Championship Road Race experience in Glasgow. We've already heard a little bit about it. But Larry, give us the full summary of your trip to Scotland. Any cultural observations you'd like to make, but also we're mainly interested in your race on Sunday.
Yeah, so I guess in terms of the race, I came straight from Poland. So flew the night after the last stage. And so I wasn't in Glasgow or Scotland for a very long time, but it was a pleasant experience.
How was that, Larry, coming from that seemed like quite a hectic schedule itinerary for a lot of riders. I mean, I thought about Michał Kwiatkowski as well, who won. He didn't win in Poland. He finished on the podium in Poland, didn't he? But he came straight to Glasgow and he was the only rider in the Polish team. But there were quite a few of you, weren't there, who came directly from Poland, which I think is kind of unusual. You wouldn't ordinarily do a 1-week stage race and then go and ride the Worlds a couple of days later.
Yeah, I mean, I would say on a normal course, it would have been probably quite good. I think like a 270K race is fatiguing enough that like you don't need to be crazy fresh. But I would say with this course, with all the accelerations, it probably wasn't the best prep, you know? For example, like Liège, you know, a lot of guys usually do quite well coming off of Tour of the Alps. But yeah, it's a gamble, I guess. And, you know, I know there were quite a few guys who stopped a few days early, like Sam Bennett, Olaf Coy, and maybe one or two others. I would say on my flight, there were probably around like 15 riders, actually. So quite a few guys went from Poland to the race. Maybe in the end it was a little bit much for this course. So with the national team, we were kind of like staying in the middle of nowhere. But it was really beautiful. It was actually, I guess I have been to Scotland before during the Tour of Britain, but I didn't see a whole lot when I was there. And I have to say it was really like picturesque and beautiful. And I really enjoyed riding around where we were, even if the weather was not exactly the same as the Côte d'Azur. So, you know, it rained like pretty much our whole ride the day before the race. And then, it was very cloudy. But, I guess as the race went, my job was sort of like to keep Nielsen Paulus out of trouble for the whole run into the circuit and everything like that, and position him well for like the climbs on the circuit. So pretty much from like 50K in to 120K in. And so, yeah, we were right at the front next to, you know, the guys who were riding and like Australian team. And yeah, we were in good position. We were on the front row for the protest, but unfortunately we didn't really get to see. I wanted to like go up there and see what was going on, but they wouldn't let us go see the drama.
Did you know what was going on, roughly?
Well, yeah, because like the UCI president came and then was telling us what was happening. And we were literally like on the front row, so we were talking to him and then he explained. There was a lot of things. Then I was next to my trade teammate, Benoit Cosnefroy. And it was kind of funny because he was like, he said in French something that I misunderstood. And he said, yeah, ici, ils ont pas le droit de tirer les gens. And there are two translations for the word tirer, which is to pull or to shoot.
You went with the American. And
me being American, I was like, he's like, in France, to me, I thought he said, in France, we just shoot him, you know? And I was like, wow, like, that's crazy. And then he started laughing when he realized that I misinterpreted the two uses of the word, and he meant they pull them off the road. So anyway, they told us that they had an anti-glue truck coming to remove the people from the road, which we were all shocked that that was a thing that existed. To be honest, actually, no one was that upset about it. Everyone was just kind of like pretty relaxed, and it was pretty, pretty good ambiance in the Peloton. And then, we sat there for 50 minutes and then got going again. It was like a full sprint into the climb. We went really hard up the climb, and then, it was pretty much chaos until the entrance of the circuit. And when we turned onto the circuit, we turned like left onto one of the hills, and it was just like a full sprint up the hill. I was a bit dead from having ridden on the front for a while, and didn't have the greatest legs, but there were so many people cheering my name around the circuit. So if any of those people were cycling podcast listeners, thank you.
Of course they were cycling podcast listeners. Why else would they be cheering your
exactly.
name? I mean, Palmares notwithstanding.
That was awesome. So actually, even once I got like dropped from the bunch, I just did a lap solo by myself because I thought I was really enjoying it. So it was
just
cool.
Peacocking through the streets
exactly,
of Glasgow.
Yeah.
Larry, talking about the circuit, just wind back the clock a little bit and tell us... I don't know whether, because I just looked on your Strava file, you mentioned how picturesque it was. It looks like you were staying in a place or near a place called Kirkdean in the Borders. Is that right?
Yeah, it was like Scottish Borders. I mean, it was called Netherard, but
right.
I don't know if that's like...
And you sort of headed towards Peebles and
Cardrona. We went for coffee in Peebles.
But just what had been the verdict and what had been the reaction? I don't know whether you personally had gone into Glasgow and seen the circuit maybe on the Saturday, but what was the feeling in the American camp? Because, you know, we read and we talked quite a lot, Lionel and I, about particularly the French were extremely dissatisfied with the circuit. And in fact, after the road race, Thomas Vauclair, the national coach, said, "This isn't road cycling. It wasn't road cycling, in my opinion," in reference to the fact that it was maybe more like what we would sort of consider a crit.
Oh, it was definitely.
What are the Americans? What had you guys thought?
Since we were kind of far from the circuit, and there was also, I think, the junior race the day before our race. So they had previewed the course like the day that I flew in, you know, so the last day of Poland. So I didn't get to see the circuit before we raced it. And essentially they were all just like laughing at me, like how much of a shock I'm going to have when we hit it. Cause they were essentially just saying, it's a crit. And I would affirm, it was a criterium. And I think, you know, the thing is we saw it, it was so, I guess, selective because, you know, normally criteriums don't last 6 hours. Right. It was essentially you can't say it was maybe took us a few hours to get to the circuit, but it was more than a 3 hour long criterium and with some hills. And that's pretty, that's pretty fatiguing. And that'll definitely lead to a race of attrition. So I definitely would say it was a lot like a criterium, but I don't know if we can say it was a bad race if like the four strongest guys came out on top, you know? It was interesting. I mean, I would say I wouldn't do the same kind of race every single year. But, you know, I think in terms of an outsider's view, I think it was probably an awesome race to watch. But, you know, a lot of times the awesome races to watch are not the awesome races to do. I wouldn't say that I disagree with them, but I wouldn't say that they're totally correct either.
No, I think we covered this in our Arrivé sort of snap summary, our knee-jerk reaction to the race. I personally found the middle phase of the race quite difficult to get a handle on what was going on. It didn't really feel like a road race. And I suppose in the kind of the reaction to what was an absolutely, you know, barnstorming finale to the race, you know, the last, 55, 60K was you know, a gripping watch. Lots of people, including some of our listeners, have said, oh, there should be some kind of, you know, city centre series where, you know, races are held all over the world. And I suppose that thought made me think that actually that the old adage that it's the riders that make the race is actually the key point, because our very good friend Brian Nygaard tweeted something on Sunday. He said, if Elvis Presley, Mick Jagger, David Bowie and Prince walked into a bar 39 kilometers to go at the World Championships. And I think that kind of sums it up. The thing that made it was the fact that those four riders, plus Mads Pedersen, who is just kind of, you know, half a step below them in classics terms, were at the front going shoulder to shoulder.
Is he Prince in that analogy?
I think that's pretty good. I mean, yeah, I was wondering, you know, I was going to say the Beatles, but then, you know, somebody's got to be Paul McCartney, haven't they? And I was wondering which was which. I suppose Tadej Pogacar's got to be John Lennon. And then Van der Poel and Van Aert draw the slightly short straw. I'm going to upset Paul McCartney fans here, but I'd rather be George Harrison than Paul McCartney. So I say Van der Poel is the George Harrison, and poor old Mads Pedersen's got to be Ringo, I guess. But, you know, if there was a kind of global circuit series, it would be only that compelling if that profile of rider came and raced and took it seriously. And the thing that made everyone take it seriously was the fact that it's the World Championships and there's a rainbow jersey on the line. So it's not just about the course. It's about the riders. It's about what's at stake. And that's what made it the compelling watch that it was. As a sort of sporting spectacle, as I say, that kind of, once they got to the circuit, there was almost this kind of feeling their way in the dark for a few laps. And I certainly, as a spectator, didn't really know where we were. The Glasgow streets took a few laps to get to grips with. Is that the same corner that as we saw, you know, 15 minutes ago? Oh no, that's the next one. You know, there was this sense of discombobulation as a TV spectator, but undoubtedly the atmosphere, and I've spoken to a few people who are up there on the side of the road, the atmosphere was incredible, electrifying, kind of city centre racing is very compelling. But whether it would stretch out over a sort of a series or bear repeating as a world championship, probably not every year, but, you know, once every decade to have a real city centre race, I think it's a different test for the riders, isn't it?
For sure. Yeah, and I think like you said, I think the ambiance, everything was really, really cool. So, you know, I thought it was also a nice experience. It's just, yeah, maybe not every year, but I think there's a place for it, for sure.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
And Larry, what was the feeling in the US camp after the road race? I mean, Nilsson had done a good race. Obviously, he didn't manage to grab onto the coattails of the, you know, the Glasgow Beatles, as Lionel dubbed them. But he was in the thick of the action.
Yeah, I mean, we were pretty happy with, like, the race overall. It was just right at the end. I mean, yeah, we were a bit upset that he got caught by this group from behind, who, I don't know, they thought was totally actually out of the race. And they were, the last time check they had on this group behind was that they were 3 minutes behind them. And all of a sudden they were just there. I would say our camp was rather upset about that development. And yeah, for us, he should have been, like, I don't know, maybe sixth or something. So that was too bad. But, yeah, I guess that happens. And, you know, I think he did a really good race. I think it was a bit of a shame that crash from Narvaez kind of split that group up. And he was really disappointed about that because, yeah, once that happened, he was the only guy trying to sort of close the gap to those four guys in front. But yeah, you know, that also is part of racing too. So yeah.
And Larry, this was your first senior World Road Race Championships, is that right? Yeah, you rode, I think, the under-23s.
I did,
in Valkenburg in 2012, I think it was. So, I mean, just how did it come about, you know, getting in the team? What's that process like? And, I mean, given the nature of the course, obviously the team needed somebody to do that big stretch over from Edinburgh and to Glasgow and the two climbs, particularly the Crow Road climb. So I guess that was, well, you said that was what you were in the team for, but how did it all come about getting selected?
Yeah, so I mean, I actually, when I was national champ, I should have gone, but then unfortunately I crashed in the Vuelta and broke my hand, so couldn't go that year. And then, there were some other times where, like, maybe it would have been possible, but I wasn't exactly the most motivated at the end of the year. So this was the first time that it sort of worked out. I was a replacement for Matteo Jorgensen when he pulled out of the tour. I guess they choose based on, a lot of different things, you know, your qualities as a rider.
Cycling mainly.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, they heard I made a good coffee, so they wanted to bring me. I think for me, my whole, there are some automatic qualification possibilities, but the auto qualifiers are like, you essentially have to maybe podium in a monument. It might be win a Grand Tour stage, but it's like they're very difficult to auto qualify. So, and then you can be national champion. So, Quinn Simmons, after he pulled out of the tour, he didn't want to go. So he gave up his spot. And then, I don't know, maybe Nielsen auto qualified, but there was maybe only, I don't know if there were really any auto qualifications. And it's pretty tough to auto qualify. And then after that, it's like a discretionary pick. And so you have to essentially fill out this petition and say like why essentially you would be a good fit. And you give them like your Training Peaks login so they can see your training and everything. But essentially, I don't think they really look at your Training Peaks. I think they know everyone and they just choose who they think would be sort of like the best team. I guess my thing on the petition was just that, you know, I think I have probably the most experience of any of the American riders. And I've done like 17 monuments and like 30 something classics. And I'm a good helper.
Can you trash other people on the petition?
Oh yeah,
and your application. Saying why
everyone else is shit.
It.
Just take me, you know. No.
Sounds quite fun.
I know for the Olympics in the past, I've heard that that can sort of happen. You kind of need to like put in essentially why you would be better than other certain people, but I don't know.
Well, it's a zero sum game, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's me or it's kill or be killed. Larry, before we will wind up talking about the World Championship, just your reaction to the winner, and I don't know if you actually watched, you know, how things played out at the start of the race. Sorry, at the front end of the race, in the last few laps. Mathieu van der Poel, popular winner, and in the sort of analysis, post-race analysis, a lot of people have talked about how, well, he was the favourite, he was the perfect rider on that course. Would you agree with that as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I think, so we were on the bus watching the finish, we were on the bus watching the finish, and from about 60K to go, we saw kind of how everything played out. And one thing we said was when there was those four guys in front, we said pretty much we'd be happy if any of the four won. It's like all four would have been great world champions. So, you know, Mads Pedersen, he was cool. I mean, Vanderpool, awesome rider. Tade would have been awesome. Just that would have been a really cool to have a Tour de France contender, you know, be the world champion. And Wout van Aert is a super classy rider too. So You know, and they're all pretty well liked in the peloton at the same time. So, yeah, we were like, any of them would have been cool, but I think Vanderpool, that'll be a really cool world champion. So
that was Larry's dog in the background saying why he shouldn't go to the Vuelta.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
One thing we didn't mention on Sunday, Daniel, and I suppose does bear mentioning, and what a contrast for Vanderpool compared to Wollongong last year, where, of course, you know, he was arrested, wasn't he, after two teenage girls pranked him in the hotel, knocking on the door repeatedly until quite late into the evening, certainly when there's a World Championship road race to do the next morning. And then, well, Vanderpool came out, didn't he? And, yeah, I mean, the reports of what specifically happened a little bit hazy, but, you know, did he grab one of the girls' arms or, you know, knock them against a wall? The charges were dropped, weren't they? But it put a real cloud over Vanderpool and the Dutch team going into the race. And I think he pulled out after about 35 kilometers of the race. It should also be said, he come in not feeling 100%. Was struggling with a little bit of illness, and I think was staying on a different floor in the hotel to the rest of the Dutch team and sort of semi-quarantining from them, which is perhaps why there was the issue with people knocking on his door. But yeah, a real sort of turnaround from a year ago. Well, not quite a year ago, because the Worlds was a little bit later, wasn't it? And one other thing I wanted to mention was we saw on Twitter from our very good friend Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, of course. He took a photo because he was in one of the cars going round. People were asking, what does race radio do when there's no race radio for the riders? And well, the simple answer for that is there's still race radio for the team directors, isn't there? So that they know when riders need mechanical support or, you know, bike change or what have you. Anyway, Seb saw, I'm going to assume, friends of the podcast, with a Buffalo Forever flag in honor of our great friend Richard Moore, of course. And well, I think can speak for Daniel when I say thank you very much for representing Richard there up in his home country over the weekend.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Well, chaps, I think that's just about as much cleaning up as we need to do from the World Championships, World Championship road race, at least, in Glasgow the weekend. Talking of cleaning up, though, I know that Mathieu van der Poel's now sort of mythical shoe bezel that he tore off following his crash on the final lap. I saw that had been retrieved and photographed. I don't know if we know in whose possession it is, but that will now become a very valuable object, item of cycling memorabilia. This got me thinking, actually. Well, a colleague of ours, Jan-Peter de Vlieger of Het Nieuwsblad in Belgium, got me thinking. I think he was writing something about these sort of, well, whether any other similar mythological objects, perhaps owing to mishaps, have also been preserved, I don't know, in museums or so on and so forth. I was thinking of Eugène Christophe's fork from the 1913 Tour de France that he supposedly repaired en route to the Tourmalet, although there's some debate over whether that actually occurred. And I was thinking as well, do you know, the one object that I would love to retrieve from cycling history, Bernard Hinault's Ray-Bans from Saint-Étienne, 1985. For Bernardino, there was a period in the 80s when he was wearing Ray-Bans to race in, Ray-Ban aviators, in fact, and he crashed in them in the 1985 Tour de France on the stage of Saint-Étienne, and the Ray-Bans actually contributed to sort of tearing half of his face off. But, yeah, they would be, I'm sure, a good and valuable one to own.
Can I chuck in Tom Steele's bidon, his water bottle, yes, that he threw in the 1997 yes, Tour de France in the sprint finish? Basically got annoyed with somebody, picked his bottle out of the bottle cage and hurled it in the hurly-burly of a sprint, and I think was disqualified from the Tour for that, wasn't he? But whatever yes, happened to the bidon?
He was. So if any of the listeners have got either of those, send them in, maybe in a jiffy bag. Larry. We very much hope that you've got a busy few weeks coming up, because you've certainly got the Vuelta a Burgos in, is it about a week's time that starts? I think you'll be racing your old buddy Primoz Roglic there. And then maybe the Vuelta a España.
Yeah, so
tell us about the next few weeks.
I have Burgos coming up. And that should be a good race, you know, normally like a Vuelta prep race. Yeah, we'll see. Usually it's a pretty good one. It's not like too crazy hard, but you have the heat, you have climbs, and usually a good chunk of the Vuelta peloton there.
And Larry, get yourself in that lovely purple leader's jersey, one of the great leader's jerseys in professional cycling. And get us one of those. Send us one of those in a jiffy bag.
Okay, please. I'll try. And then we'll see from there. I guess they'll decide the Vuelta team after that race, and I hope to be there in Barcelona at the start. So we'll know after Burgos. But
what does it depend on, Larry? What do you have to do in Burgos to?
I think I just have to have good performance. You know, what that means, I don't 100% know. But if I'm going well, I think it's an easy race to show it, because there's plenty of hard courses, big climbs, stuff like that. And so we'll see. I don't exactly know what the, you know, criteria they use are, but I don't think making a good coffee is one of them, but.
General bonhomie and a winning personality. Yeah. Larry, how have you... We didn't speak too much over the summer. Obviously, we were otherwise engaged at the Tour de France, but how did you sort of set up this second half to the season? Were you at altitude?
I was.
Talk to us a bit about your prep for the second half of the season and whether you tweaked anything from the first half, because, of course, we spoke to you a lot, both in the close season and early in the year, about things that you were maybe trying to tweak and do with your training this year.
Yeah, so I went to altitude in Andorra for 18 days. I went to a hotel called Pigmaya, which is... It's on the top of the Envalira Pass, so it's at 2,400 meters, which is pretty high. But it's a pretty good setup. There were a lot of other riders there. Ineos was there having like a sort of team camp with, probably like 6-8 guys, mostly of Vuelta team, as well as Pauline Ferrand-Prevot getting ready for Worlds.
So you can tell us they have Vuelta team then. You can unveil the
I don't know. That was like provisional Vuelta team. But it was Garrett Thomas, Pavel Sivakov, Lawrence de Plus,
Remco Evenepoel.
Yeah. No, but there were a lot of Belgians there also. There was probably, I would say in total, around 20 riders at this hotel. Bora had a few. There were riders from Topsport Vlaanderen, Intermarché. It was really crazy. It was a full hotel. And so yeah, that was pretty much my July. I did 18 days up there. Came down a few days before Poland, and was home for only about like 3 nights, and then went straight to Poland. Poland straight to the World Championships. Now I'm at least home for a few days, so that's good.
Why had you decided to go to that particular hotel in Andorra, Larry, and not? You've been to other...
Yeah.
Well, you usually go to Isola 2000, which is much closer to home for you.
100%. So a few reasons. I went there last year. And it was really good. So I decided to go back. But yeah, I guess the reason in the past, I've gone to Livigno a lot in the summer. But Livigno is really hit or miss with the weather. It's a beautiful place. But it's almost like there are too many riders and too many distractions. You know, it's like a lot of fun things to do in Livigno. And so I would say, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's like a lot of restaurants. There's a lot of, you know, there's always people that want to like go out and do something, which is actually super nice. But like, I guess the reason I'm going on an altitude camp is to like buckle down and be serious and really focus. So I was like, maybe better I just sort of go to Andorra, which is a bit more boring than Livigno.
Boredom, boredom is the new altitude.
Yeah, exactly.
Andorra is yeah, altitude with the fun sucked out, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
You're very fond of Andorra.
I would say maybe.
I mean, if you like shopping, Andorra's great.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. But yeah, so I don't know. I had a really, last year it worked out really well. I felt really good after. So that was kind of why I wanted to go back, because it's warmer. It's a little bit higher, which I think that can make a difference as well. And then, yeah, I guess there's also, there are more people there to ride with. It's also, to go to, in Isola, there's not really hotels that much. It's more apartments. So it's kind of nice to have your food cooked for you rather than cooking for yourself. You know, if you're training really hard and things like that. So yeah, it was kind of a combination of things, and yeah, so it was a good camp. Boring, but I think productive. So,
well, Larry, we hope you reap the rewards of the altitude and the boredom at the Vuelta a Burgos.
I hope so too.
After that, the Vuelta. But Chas, before we go, Lionel, we've got the world individual time trial, men and women. Is the men on the same day as the women this week?
No, the women are on Thursday, the men are on Friday. Then, of course, the women's road race is on Sunday too, as the World Championships, the Super Worlds, wraps up in Scotland. But we'll be back next week to talk a bit about the time trial, I guess. I mean, the men's time trial is going to be quite interesting, I suppose, because, well, it's... There's riders that have kind of swept the medals over the last few years, isn't there? Filippo Ganna won in 2020 and 2021, just got himself a rainbow jersey on the track in the pursuit, of course. Remco Evenepoel and Wout van Aert will be riding for Belgium. Van Aert's had two silver medals in 2020 and 2021, and Evenepoel, bronze medalist the last 2 years and silver medalist in 2019. Then, of course, there's the Swiss challenge. Stefan Kung, who's got a silver and a bronze to his name in recent years, and Stefan Bissiger. Not expecting too much from the reigning champion, Tobias Foss, though, are we, of Norway? A slight surprise winner last year. Hasn't really replicated that performance in time trials this year. The men's time trial is almost 48 kilometres long. It's starting and finishing in Stirling and has a little kicker at the finish. So wow, it's going to be for one of those guys, isn't it? The big engines, the Filippo Ganna, Wout van Aert, Remco Evenepoel. I mean, well, take your pick. Could be in that order, maybe.
Yeah, I think revenge for Remco after, well, not winning at the weekend. He did a ride yesterday, a sort of test ride. He posted it on Strava, and I don't think I've ever seen anyone set as many new KOMs as or get as many new sort of best times on segments as Remco did in his ride yesterday. He did. I think the title of the ride was Speed, so he was trying to go fast, and he succeeded. So yeah, he'd be my favorite. Larry, tip before we go.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to say Remco. I thought for me, it's going to be between Remco and Ganna, but I'm pretty sure Remco will take it. yeah, to me, I thought Remco was going to be almost an outside pick considering he didn't deliver as much in the road race. But to me, I think he's probably been focusing on sustained efforts for the Vuelta, and with that super punchy kind of Criterium-like course, I think it just didn't suit him that well. But I still think he showed he was pretty strong earlier on the earlier laps. But yeah, I just don't think it was the course for him. So I wouldn't be surprised if he blitzes this TT.
Larry, it's been a delight. It's been a pleasure to have you back. And you're off to lunch in Italy now.
Yes.
You're just going to hop over the border, hop down the Riviera in your linen slacks and your white blazer. And we'll have a lovely time. have a lovely, fruitful time in Burgos. We very much hope we'll be seeing you. And we'll be talking to you probably on a daily basis if you're at the Vuelta a España. And until then, Larry, goodbye.
ciao. Thanks, everyone. Hopefully I'll be back soon.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Burney.